The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, here on News Dissector Radio on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Heard every week at this time. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm a blogger. I'm a filmmaker, and I also consider myself a troublemaker. So the title of the first author who we're going to be meeting today, whose book is called Troublemaker, resonates with my own life and my own experience. Before we start, though, we want to acknowledge the capture of the Bosnian Serb general, Ratko Mladic. Mladic was accused and is being accused of war crimes. He's been turned over to the tribunal in The Hague. He's facing charges of having been responsible for the massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica in Bosnia back in 1995. It's taken a long time for him to be captured, largely because the Serbian government was not moving too quickly, but they are now because they want to join the European community, and as a result, they're trying to show good faith and producing this ex-general, this war criminal. And so it's going to be a very interesting trial as the dirty details of the whole war in Bosnia came out. One of the things that impressed me was earlier in the week, Serbian television acknowledged that it had carried on a campaign of lies and misinformation and disinformation in the run-up to the war in the Balkans. They acknowledged that they were part of what was creating the war. So this is another indication of how much media matters. When media plays a role of actually seeking truth and reporting on what's happening, we can avoid wars. When media collaborates, is complicit with, and actually accelerates the drift to war as it had in the Balkans, in that period, and also in Iraq, in our own lifetimes, in our own recent memories, we can see that media actually becomes a tool for making war. And this is something that this particular case should reintroduce us to, because whenever you talk about politics in America anyway, you talk about media. And that's why ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com is so important. Hopefully, the MediaChannel.org, which I edit, is also valuable in terms of the perspectives, the diverse views, and the analysis that we offer every day. Our site is produced by Global Vision. You're welcome to visit us and participate in this effort to try to bring people who are concerned about media from all over the world together. So that's what we're going to be talking about as a secondary theme today as we move back into the past, into the 1960s, honoring first the musician responsible for this song, who just turned 70 years old.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times, they are a-changing.
Well, the times did change, and in some ways they changed back, and maybe they're changing back again. Joining us now, an old friend of mine, someone I have a great respect and admiration for, Bill Zimmerman, with a doctorate from the University of Chicago. He's become one of the country's most experienced political consultants with the firm of Zimmerman and Markman, based in Los Angeles. On the other hand, Bill had a history very similar to my own, in that he became immersed in the conflicts of the 1960s as an activist and as an organizer, as somebody who brought a unique contribution, which he now details in a memoir, from the front lines of the 60s. It's a beautifully written book, but from Doubleday, Bill Zimmerman's book, Troublemaker. Hey, Bill, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Danny. Nice to hear you again.
There you go. Well, but Bill and I should disclose, shared, you know, a house in Somerville, Mass. Back in the 1970s when I was working as the news dissector at WBCN Radio, reporting on some of the news that Bill was actually creating. Bill, tell us a little bit about your history, or tell the people who are not familiar with you. You grew up in Chicago. You really weren't coming out of a very political family, as I understand it. You were you were a lifeguard. You were, you know, interested in sports. You later became a pilot. You don't have the M.O., so to speak, of, you know, the hippie renegade. And yet you drifted into politics, and politics took over your life. Tell us about that.
Well, you're right, Danny. I grew up as a working class kid, and in high school, early years of college, I was a lifeguard. As a high school student, I aspired to be a military pilot. And then I was fortunate enough to win a scholarship to the University of Chicago, and my exposure to new ideas and critical thinking there changed my life. In the spring of 1963, I went to Mississippi to work briefly for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and I got a look at the Southern Civil Rights Movement, which was an enormous inspiration to me. I had no idea of the kind of oppression that existed in the United States and in the Southern states with regard to the Jim Crow laws. And I was inspired by the young black students working in the South against those laws. Later, when the war in Vietnam broke out...
Let me just jump in here for a moment, because you went South with a fellow Chicagoan, how do you say that?
Chicagoan, yes.
Okay, named Danny Lyon, who is one of the great photographers of the Civil Rights Movement. If you're interested,
well, Danny and I were buddies at the University of Chicago, not so much because of political activity, but because we both had an interest in riding English motorcycles. And we had a little group of people that drove out to southern Indiana on the weekends to race bikes. And I befriended Danny as part of that group. And then in the summer of 62, Danny went south. He was an amateur photographer, and he started taking pictures of the civil rights movement, which at that point was in its very early stages.
He had become actually almost the house photographer for SNCC in those years, and his photographs are great, and he was known for his motorcycle riding. I have a little story, Bill, here, which I will have to tell because it's been on my heart and in my mind for all these years. After the little girls were killed in the church in Birmingham, there was a demonstration in New York at the federal courthouse, and I came to it, and I drove there. I was very excited. I saw the marchers. I parked. At that time, you could park in front of the courthouse, and I unfortunately banged into a motorcycle which was right in front of my car, which went over on the side. And whose motorcycle was it but Danny Lyon? So that was my introduction to him, which was not exactly a great way to meet somebody who you really admire. At any rate, a little bit later on the program, in the second half hour, James Swerg is going to be joining us. James Swerg was one of the original Freedom Riders, and they were just the film The Freedom Riders on PBS. James was somebody who was beaten in those demonstrations, and we're going to hear more from him a little bit later on. So carrying on with your narrative, Bill.
Well, after the war in Vietnam broke out, a lot of people who had been involved with the Southern Civil Rights Movement coalesced rapidly into an anti-war movement. And the rest is common knowledge. I wanted to write a memoir of those years because I wanted to describe what it felt like to be swept up into those political movements. And not only what it felt like, but what impact it had. Because a lot of us who did join the moral crusades in the 60s were transformed by them. In my own case, I managed to stay in school long enough to earn a PhD and begin a career as a brain researcher. But when I discovered that the Army was using research similar to mine to develop a new nerve gas for deployment in Vietnam, I felt compelled to leave science and become a full-time anti-war activist. And in that capacity, I had a lot of experiences that were common to many people in my generation. I participated in all the big marches in New York and Washington. I was at the March on the Pentagon. I was part of campus sit-ins and building takeovers. I fought the cops on the streets of Chicago and again on the streets of our nation's capital in 1971 during the May Day demonstrations. So the experiences I had were emblematic of my generation. But I also had a number of experiences that were unique, and I thought uniquely interesting to write about.
Let me just introduce some of them, because I was also, of course, I was an activist journalist, so I was covering these marches, but also sort of participating in them. So it was sort of a participatory form of journalism. I didn't make any particular apologies for it. You know, I took a stand along with so many others and reported on it, tried to be part of that brigade of journalists that were trying to tell us the truth at a time when most of the press in America was actually echoing what the government was saying, as you know, Bill, and was not really telling people what was going on. But one of the unique aspects of your own contribution, and this is something I came to know about later, was the formation of an organization called Medical Aid for Indochina, which actually took you to Hanoi in the height of the bombing in North Vietnam, where you experienced air raids and you helped rebuild a large hospital, the Bac Mai Hospital, which I visited 2 years later when I went to North Vietnam.
Well, as you recall, in the spring of 1972, Nixon started bombing the cities in North Vietnam. And I was asked by the North Vietnamese to come to the country with three other Americans and film some of the bomb damage to civilian targets. I went there in May of 1972 with a color film camera. I was the first American allowed to shoot color film in North Vietnam, and I saw things that horrified me. Apartment buildings bombed in the middle of the night, schools, churches, even hospitals, intentionally bombed by the United States. I met an 8-year-old boy in Haiphong who had been bombed by B-52s as he slept in his apartment at 2:30 in the morning, then taken injured to the Vietnamese Czechoslovakian Friendship Hospital, where he was injured a second time when the bombers came back at 10 a.m. and bombed the hospital. So after seeing scenes like this all over North Vietnam and surviving 18 bombing attacks while I was there, I came back and made a film called Village by Village, which argued that Nixon was intentionally targeting civilians in order to terrorize them and get them to revolt against or oppose their own government in the middle of the war.
A policy which was indeed a total failure, but beyond that,
right,
it also showed us that states commit terrorism, often deadlier terrorism than individuals do.
That was certainly the case in North Vietnam. I also, when I was there, met and filmed 8 captured American pilots who had turned against the war. And I filmed them making statements condemning the bombing and got that footage on 60 Minutes after my return. And once those prisoners talked about being endangered by the bombing themselves, while Nixon was arguing that the bombing was likely to get them home sooner, Nixon and Kissinger stopped using the prisoners as a foil in the arguments they were making for continuing the war.
But also getting that story out at that time was sort of going against the accepted narrative, you know, that the pilots
were
the victims, and that, you know, kind of the theme of the old Rambo movies later on, that they were the heroes of the war and were mistreated. Some were. But, you know, the whole reality of what they experienced was not really communicated, was it?
No, not at all. And the truth is that in 1969, before he died, Ho Chi Minh ordered that no prisoners be tortured. And there was no torture after 1969, although there had been some prior to that point. That didn't stop people like John McCain from allowing the public to believe that he had been tortured throughout his captivity. While it wasn't true, it made for an interesting electoral narrative.
And it gave him the patina, if you will, of great heroism, which he exploited to the hilt at the Republican convention and his race for presidency.
Yes.
You know, so we see that symbols emerge out of these conflicts, which go on, you know, to either emerge as popular symbols or as symbols to be despised. And this was a battle of images in many ways between the activists who opposed the war, the people who stood up against it, who went to jail against it, who exposed documents, who fought against the war in the military and outside the military, and, of course, the official narrative, the government, and the various forces it mobilized to try to sell the war to the American people. And that battle that we saw back then, we're seeing again today, aren't we?
Yeah, we certainly are. And, you know, we learned during those years, during the years of the Vietnam War, to use some of those symbols effectively ourselves. In December of 1972, during the so-called Christmas bombing, when Nixon and Kissinger basically destroyed much of the city of Hanoi, one of their targets was the Bach Mai Hospital that you mentioned earlier. It was the largest civilian hospital in North Vietnam, 1,100 beds. I visited it in the spring of 72 and found a relatively modern facility, especially for a third world country like North Vietnam. They destroyed that hospital the night of December 19th, 1972, and denied that there had been any damage. Fortunately, there were four Americans in Hanoi at the time, including the folk singer-songwriter Joan Baez and Professor Telford Taylor, who had been the United States chief prosecutor at Nuremberg during the Nazi war crimes trials. They testified to the utter destruction of the hospital. So knowing that we had caught the Pentagon in a lie, the Medical Aid for Indochina organization, which I headed at the time, launched a project to rebuild that hospital in Hanoi with American dollars. And we took out full-page ads in the New York Times, held press conferences, we did a benefit concert in the National Cathedral the night before Nixon's second inauguration, and in many ways publicized over the denials of the Pentagon, the destruction of this hospital, which became a powerful symbol for convincing the American people that the war in Vietnam was not only wrong, but one in which the United States was using the tactics of terror, as you just described.
Well, we're seeing something similar here, you know, in the war in Libya, where hospitals have been attacked and where whole stretches of civilian areas have been attacked, although this is not getting the kind of press in the American media that it's getting in the European media. One of the things I can testify to is having visited the Bach Mai Hospital myself on a reporting trip, which included a stop in North Vietnam in Hanoi. And, you know, a lot of work had been done to rebuild that hospital. When you talked to the doctors there who had experienced the attack on the hospital, you really came face to face with a sort of tremendous amount of heroism and guts and courage of people who wanted to do their job as physicians despite, you know, the obvious risks of getting killed in a war. And I think that was a very heroic period for North Vietnam. And as we see, the bombing of North Vietnam, which was massive, unprecedented, was not effective in ending the war, just as the bombing, the shock and awe in Iraq was unsuccessful, just as the bombing in Libya will be unsuccessful. And yet these same tactics are used because they're almost part of a playbook. But what interested me, Bill, was not only your descriptions of that era, which I must say, and which is one reason I really urge people to read this book, Troublemaker, because Bill doesn't just tell a personal story, you know, I met so-and-so and I did this, but he offers the context, the background, the analysis of what was actually happening at the time. These are details that really have sort of slipped away in our media, which often reduces everything, you know, like Martin Luther King's speech in Washington to four words, I have a dream, you know, as if nothing else was happening there. And what I'm particularly struck by, and there's a whole chapter here that I don't think most of us know. You know, when the anti-war activists claim that we helped stop the war, we usually point to the demonstrations and to all of that. But there was something else going on, Bill, that you were part of, which was a congressional lobbying effort. You sort of went from being a street militant to an insider lobbyist in Congress, working with congressmen to try to cut off the financing to the war, and that is partly what actually ended the war. I mean, obviously, the invasion of Saigon, the North Vietnamese attack, the uprisings in South Vietnam, you know, put the, you know, basically finished it off. But there was a drama going on in the Congress, which may be relevant for today, which many people don't know about. You want to tell us a little about that?
Sure. Most of the history of the anti-war movement really just covers the first half of the anti-war movement, up to 1969 when SDS and the student movement collapsed. And then following the May Day demonstrations and other demonstrations in 1971, many of us in the anti-war movement realized that we were having no impact with large demonstrations, and we had to find tactics that involved larger numbers of Americans who were beginning to turn against the war, but were unwilling to risk arrest and go out and demonstrate or fight police. So we developed new organizations, one of which was Medical Aid for Indochina that we've just discussed. Another was the Indochina Peace Campaign. And in 1973, after the Paris Peace Accords were signed, which removed American combat forces, the war continued with U.S. funding. The Congress was funding and continued to fund for 2 years. The regime in South Vietnam, 90% of its budget was derived from U.S. aid, and it continued to pursue the war. We organized a grassroots lobbying campaign in which we targeted those members of Congress who were ambivalent about the war and who could be moved, and encouraged a very large number of people to phone, call, visit those members of Congress. We isolated their funding sources and convinced some of their funders to contact them and encourage them to oppose the appropriations that were paying for the South Vietnamese military. We didn't try to cut that number, that is the number of dollars going to South Vietnam, to zero, because we felt we lacked the strength to do that. But in our first attempt, we cut the military budget from $1.6 million to $1.1 billion. That was a cut of about one-third. And in the second year, we cut the same request for $1.6 billion down to $800,000, which was half. And because of those budget cuts in Congress, which Nixon couldn't do anything about, the South Vietnamese military had fewer planes, less fuel, fewer bullets. In other words, their supplies and the materiel they needed to continue waging the war were gradually reduced to the point where the North Vietnamese and the National Liberation Front in South Vietnam could overwhelm them militarily. And finally did so on April 30th, 1975, when the war came to an end. But absent that lobbying campaign, many historians believe that Nixon would have violated the peace accords and resumed the bombing in order to protect the South Vietnamese military. And absent that grassroots lobbying campaign, that's likely what would have happened.
Well, you know, there's a saying that William Faulkner, the writer, you know, kind of a phrase that he used, saying the past is never past. And you know, it's important to notice that Henry Kissinger, still at it after all these years, is going to be speaking and receiving some sort of, you know, praise acknowledgement at the 92nd Street Y here in New York.
That's remarkable.
Next week. He's still at it, and protests are planned to welcome him as, you know, and identify him as a war criminal. So,
well, I would encourage all of your listeners in New York to attend those protests, because America has never produced a war criminal of the magnitude of Henry Kissinger. This man launched the bombing of North Vietnam, the Christmas bombing in 1972, in which thousands of civilians were killed and maimed, simply to improve his negotiating position with the North Vietnamese, with whom he was trying to negotiate a peace settlement.
Right, and the one thing we have to give the North Vietnamese credit for, Le Duc Tho, who was the negotiator for North Vietnam, he was given the Nobel Peace Prize with Henry Kissinger, and he rejected it and refused to go to Oslo to accept that peace prize because he believed that, you know, the victim and the victimizer should not be equally honored. And this is something, you know, to this day where we saw President Obama being given a peace prize for not really creating too much peace, you know, is an issue that still is with us after all this time. You know, Bill, we're getting through quite a bit of what's in your book, and I felt like this chapter was so important because it's completely forgotten by most people about how the war ended. You know, the only images given are the images of military confrontation, the American helicopters falling off the ship into the water, the, you know, desperate rush of people to get out of South Vietnam and get out of Saigon. But this work that was done quietly, patiently, in a very organized manner, which you were part, you know, I think played a very decisive role. And I think if you read this book, Troublemaker, you will find out a lot you didn't know about what was going on behind the scenes in the anti-war movement and the protest campaigns. And I think that's why Bill's book has been endorsed by the head of MoveOn.org, by Daniel Ellsberg, by Richard Flax, who helped organize SDS, because he not only was there and did that, but he was also able to articulate and discuss what's behind it. And that's what's often missing, is that people who are part of this community, who want change, who have been working for change, are really given the opportunity, the platform, to really articulate and explain why they're doing what they're doing and how they're doing it. And so this is one of the problems that, you know, Bill and I were kind of writing back and forth, and he was very frustrated because this great book has come out. All these impressive people find this Troublemaker book really moving and very informative, and yet it's almost impossible for him to get on TV to talk about it. And instead we have this parade of celebrities and you know, endless commentary on the sex scandals and the like, but no real, reporting on this. And so I said, Bill, please come on my program. Obviously, I don't have the reach of some of these other shows, but I think when we do the podcast, we can get it out widely, and I think it's important that we do it. And I just realized it's now we're almost at the half-hour point, and we didn't even get to the issue, which actually, you know, kind of put you in jail, which was an amazing episode in the 70s that I also have personal knowledge of the airlift to Wounded Knee. Where the American Indian movement was basically holding out against a really repressive effort there. And, you know, and today, even to this day, prominent American Indian activists are in prison or being accused of all sorts of crimes that really have been part of the injustice of the treatment of Native Americans. Bill, is there any chance for you to stay with us for a little while?
Sure, Danny. Happy to.
Because I think, you know, we're really cooking here. We're trying to deal with a lot. I mean, your book is, let me just take a quick look here. We're talking now some 450 pages almost. We're trying to boil it down into some chatter and chat. But we're going to be joined in the next half hour by a young man who was part of the Freedom Rides, who himself was physically attacked and brutalized, who was interviewed in his hospital bed, which communicated with a lot of people. He came from the state of Wisconsin, which is, of course, the center of resistance today, born in Appleton, Wisconsin. He studied at Beloit College. He became involved in civil rights, and he's going to be joining us to talk a little bit about the Freedom Rides. But you, in my view, Bill, are also a freedom rider, and in that freedom ride, whether on motorcycle, Cessna plane, or in your Jeep for the duration. So I'd like you to stay with us. Bill Zimmerman, the book Troublemaker, he's going to stick with us. Stay with us here on News Dissector Radio on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. How am I doing, Bill?
You're doing fine, Danny.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, dear.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello! This is Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host of Animal Magnet Pet Radio. You can listen live to me every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern for the best pet radio in America, Canada, and beyond. Hard-hitting pet issues, animal news, training tips, tricks, games, and quirky pet trivia, plus the A-list pet guests each week. Or listen anytime to past shows at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Listen to this show so you can be good to your animals.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Everyone, this is Richard Martin, host of your bi-weekly wake-up call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, coming to you live all the way from Singapore. I try to cut through the lies and misinformation to bring you what you need to know to prepare for the economic horrors that lie ahead. I'll give it to you straight in simple language. I don't sugarcoat the news. Unlike the government and media, I have no agenda other than to make you aware of ways in which you can protect yourselves and your loved ones. That's the wake-up call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. here on Progressive Radio Network.
Did you miss your favorite show on Progressive Radio Network? Well, no need to worry. We have all of our shows archived on our website. Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com/archives and find the show you're looking for.
I'm on my way. The Freedom Rides of 1961 were a simple but daring plan to deliberately violate the segregation laws of the Deep South. I won't turn
back. There's a possibility that we might be arrested. This is the only trouble that I anticipate.
You could see baseball bats and pieces of pipe.
The women, they were screaming, kill them niggas, and they had babies in their arms.
One fella had a pitchfork.
We will make sure that people...
Well, that's part of the trailer for the documentary on the Freedom Riders, Stanley Nelson, I believe, who did this incredible film that's been seen all over the country, not only on television but in communities, marking the 1961 Freedom Rides. In those years, I worked with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, which was the group really behind the Freedom Rides, working with the Freedom Ride movement, which the whole idea of which was to desegregate interstate commerce and interstate transportation, so that the Greyhound buses, the Trailways buses, and all this would be segregated in the South. Stop it at terminals that were segregated. A lot of the pictures that we see in our history books of water fountains, which are marked white and colored, were at those bus stations. And so this was a symbol of segregation, and it was a target of the civil rights movement back in 1961. And among the people who were there, it was James Swerg, who's going to be joining us in a minute. Also staying with us is Bill Zimmerman. Bill is the author of the book Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 1960s, published by Doubleday Books, a really excellent account. And we're going to hear about a campaign that he got involved in, which was basically to support the cause of Native Americans in the United States, and it coalesced around Wounded Knee. It involved an airdrop into Wounded Knee. And Bill's going to play a big role in that as one of the pilots of the planes that flew food into the encircled Indians, surrounded by the FBI, surrounded by people who were working with, you know, the Indian establishment, if you will, who were opposing the efforts of the American Indian movement to democratize the environment there in South Dakota at Wounded Knee. Of course, Wounded Knee, the symbol of a massacre in the 1890s. So we'll hear more about that. Two very dramatic moments in the freedom struggle in this country, and joining us are two people who played a role in it, Bill Zimmerman in a second, and James Swerg. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your involvement in all of this. You grew up in Wisconsin, you're a sociology student, and you basically were given a book to read, Stride to Freedom, about, you know, the civil rights movement that seemed to have really influenced you.
Well, I was influenced more by the young man that gave it to me, because he was an African American, and I saw firsthand the prejudice that he encountered in college. And he handled himself in such a manner that he never responded in kind to either verbal or physical actions. And when I approached him on it, that's when he gave me the copy of Dr. King's Stride Towards Freedom to read.
I notice also that, you know, you signed up later for an exchange semester at Fisk University, a black college in Nashville, Tennessee. Earlier, I had actually been accepted to Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, where I was planning to go to school as well, I guess in the same spirit as you did, except I ended up dropping out and working full-time in the civil rights movement. But Fisk was a hotbed of civil rights activism, and you met there John Lewis, now the congressman, then the civil rights leader and leader of SNCC, who is quoted as saying, "I was almost in awe of this young man." That's you. "He was my age, 21, but I had never met another person of my age with his commitment. He exuded a quiet strength, almost an absolute certainty that we knew, and he knew what he was doing, very open, very honest." An endorsement from John Lewis is something to die for, in a way, and you know, to hear what he said about you, Jim. So tell us more about your own thinking as you got involved.
Well, the students in Nashville, I think Nashville had a very unique situation in that John and several of the other youth leaders were seminarians. So there was a very strong spiritual element. Certainly played a role in my coming to the decision to embrace nonviolence as my way of life. I happened to be the only white male student in Nashville to be really active at that time. And, of course, my role in we were trying to integrate the movie theaters was to go and get tickets. And I was able to do that about a half dozen times. And I would turn to my partner, Bill Harbor, and we would try and enter the movie theater. We only made it through the doors once. We're knocked cold and dumped back out on the sidewalk, but I did some sit-ins with them there. We ultimately integrated the movie theaters, and I had been elected to the Central Committee, which was kind of prior to SNCC in Nashville, the student leadership. And I was in that capacity when we learned of the burning of the bus in Anniston and the beatings in Birmingham.
So this is part of the whole Freedom Ride movement. It also happened in this very month, May 14th in 1961. And you got into it, didn't you? You began to document it. Tell us what happened.
Well, once we had learned what had happened to the core ride, our initial reaction was, what can we do to show our support? And as we were discussing that, within 24 hours, the core riders had left the ride and flown on to New Orleans. We were extremely upset that that could leave a message for the segregationists that used violence, that all they would have to do is become violent enough and those demonstrating would turn tail and run. And we were very concerned that that could set back the civil rights movement literally decades, and felt very strongly that the ride had to be continued. We made that decision that we were dedicated. We had shown success during the sit-ins and the stand-ins, and felt we were ready and the logical people to continue the ride. I was simply one of those that volunteered and was selected for the first bus.
And then what happened?
Well, we decided, Paul Brooks and I, to test the laws right off the bat. So we sat from Nashville to Birmingham, two seats behind the bus driver. And when we got to Birmingham, we were shaking hands that we'd made it without incident, but the bus slowed and Bull Connors got on and announced that there were students, it was a freedom ride, and asked the bus driver to point out the Nashville students. We got pointed out very quickly. We were ultimately placed under arrest, taken down to the jail, booked. And I don't know about Paul, but they put me in the drunk tank. And while Paul and I were there, then they took the rest of the students, once they arrived in Birmingham, put them under protective custody, and that night dropped them at the border between Alabama and Tennessee. They were able to contact Nashville and get somebody to take them back to Birmingham. The second group, led by Bernard Lafayette, had taken off from Nashville and was waiting for us all in the bus terminal, and Paul and I ultimately went to trial and were found guilty, but the sentence was suspended because the judge had learned that Greyhound was going to take us on to Montgomery. We spent that night of the 19th in the bus terminal with the Klan marching back and forth in their robes. And then the following morning, we boarded the bus for Montgomery. And I was John Lewis's seatmate on that leg. And when we got to Montgomery, initially it was very quiet. As we got close to the bus terminal, there was no vehicular traffic or pedestrian traffic, and when we got off the bus, it was very quiet except for a few media folks that were standing around. And as John stepped up to the mic, he was our spokesman for that section of the ride. This fellow attacked some of the media people and grabbed the microphone and then grabbed the camera, and the fellow felt knocked down and started kicking the photographer. And that seemed to be the cue for the mob, because from around the bus bays and up the side of the driveways and around the buildings came this mob of people, you know, just screaming, get them, kill the niggers. And the police had told the Klan that they'd have about a half an hour to greet us, and they did. And I got pretty badly beaten up, ended up in the hospital.
I mean, in the great book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, Taylor Branch writes, he says, one of the men grabbed Swerg's suitcase, smashed him in the face with it. Others slugged him to the ground, and when he was dazed beyond resistance, one man pinned Swerg's head between his knees so that the others could take turns hitting him as they steadily knocked out his teeth, and his face and his chest was steaming blood. A few adults on the perimeter put their children on their shoulders to watch all this. You know, this is a pretty a major scene here in the civil rights movement. Others were beaten as well, and including the journalist John Siegenthaler, knocked unconscious when he went to the aid of one of the passengers. And you were then interviewed, weren't you, from a hospital bed?
Yes.
Tell me about that. What did you say? What did you?
Ironically, I don't remember it. I was still basically out. I remember some bright lights.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, the rest of us do remember it, because it's definitely part of the archive of the civil rights movement and one of the most eloquent testimonies to what happened. Bill Zimmerman, who's been listening in here, who's in L.A., was part of, worked with SNCC in the early days in voter registration, and, you know, didn't experience that directly, I don't believe, Bill, right, in your...
No, I didn't experience any beatings myself.
But you became part of an effort years later, and this is a part of what I'm trying to get at in terms of a nonviolent effort to assist Native Americans who were actually surrounded at Wounded Knee who were protesting. Tell us about that and the airlift to Wounded Knee.
Well, by the late 1960s and early 1970s, the civil rights work that you guys have just been discussing had inspired American Indians to also demand changes in the way they were treated by the U.S. government, particularly on the reservations in the western states. So in February of 73, American Indian Movement activists, along with residents of the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, seized the village of Wounded Knee. Wounded Knee was tremendously significant at that time because a best-selling book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee had educated Americans about that village. It was the scene of the last massacre of the Indian Wars. In December of 1890, 7th Cavalry killed 300 unarmed Indian men, women, and children at that village. So it became the symbol of what we had done to the Indian nations in the 19th century. As a result, when the Indians took it in 73, the Nixon administration didn't feel they could go in with guns blazing to dislodge the activists and produce a second massacre on that same site. So instead, they surrounded the village with 300 U.S. Marshals and FBI agents and tried to starve the 400 people in the village out without resorting to weapons. And after about 5 weeks of this, which was heavily covered by the news, this was a very dramatic story that was on the front pages of all the nation's newspapers, but about 5 weeks in, the Indians did run out of food and were on the verge of collapse and surrender. And one of their lawyers contacted me with a request that I fly food into the village. The lawyer knew that I was an amateur pilot. I then organized some friends in aviation, and we rented 3 single-engine airplanes. We found a left-wing parachute rigger in somewhere in New Mexico and incorporated him into the crew. And we parachuted close to a ton of food into the villagers at dawn on April 17th. We flew over the village just as the sun was coming over the horizon. And we were shot at 10, 12 times, presenting some danger, but not real danger. It's very difficult to hit a moving airplane with a rifle. But in any case, I had a little trouble in the plane that I was flying. One of the parachutes came out prematurely and knocked off a portion of the horizontal tail on my airplane, and that necessitated a crash landing after the drop. And because of the crash landing, which all of us on the plane survived, but the FBI was able to get our tail number and eventually arrest us. And they charged us with 3 federal crimes, each of which entailed prison sentences of 5 years. And we were under indictment for 2 years. And finally, those who had indicted us in the Nixon administration had become by then indicted themselves for crimes committed during the Watergate scandal, and charges against us were eventually dropped.
Well, let's not forget the moment that I was involved in all of this, which was when, a morning like any other in Somerville, Mass. My dog, Sophie, was outside, and suddenly FBI agents, heavily armed, surrounded the house. And Sophie, instead of defending the house, ended up playing ball with them, fetching for them. I don't think you know that detail. But suddenly there were bangs on the door, and the FBI came in search of you, Bill, to arrest you. And
right.
I was, of course, working for WBCN at the time, so I grabbed my tape recorder, came downstairs, and started recording this whole arrest. Okay.
It's hard to describe how hilarious this scene was, because the FBI agents are inside the house with guns drawn. Danny's in his pajamas, waving a tape recorder and a press card around, claiming to be covering the arrest for WBCN. And the FBI officers, seeing the press card, were flummoxed and didn't know quite how to respond. Finally, after Danny asked them 5 or 10 minutes worth of questions about what they were doing and what they thought the meaning of it was.
And where the warrant is, you know.
And where the warrant is. They finally threatened to arrest Danny for obstructing justice, at which point he backed off. And the agents then tried to go up to the second floor of our home looking for other suspects. And Danny's girlfriend at the time and one of the other women in the house stood on the stairway in their pajamas, blocking the agents, and eventually getting into a pushing match with them, which the two young women won, and the agents were blocked from going up to the second floor. Not that anyone was there for them to find anyway. But Danny had tape-recorded this entire event and played it that evening on his news show, much to the delight of the radio listening audience in Boston.
Yeah, it was a historic recording. Jim, you know, I wish there was somebody there to cover, or was there someone there to cover that riot in which you were attacked?
There were media there, but of course, one of the things that the Klan would always try and do is dissuade them from taking any pictures of an actual beating. I mean, that was one of the problems with the beating in Birmingham, is they got pictures. And so they were able to press charges. The Klan never cared if you saw the results of their beating or lynching or whatever it might have been, but they didn't want pictures taken during.
And this brings us back to the theme I was raising at the beginning of the program, is what's true and what isn't, what, you know, is being reported and what isn't. I mean, I was struck, Bill, as you were telling us this story about Wounded Knee, you know, at the fact that the SEAL Team 6, the group that went in and killed or allegedly killed Osama bin Laden, had used as his code name Geronimo, the great American Indian leader. So it was almost as if the Indian wars for them have never stopped.
Yeah, well, there was enormous displeasure with the use of the code name Geronimo to signify either the operation or the individual Osama bin Laden. And many Indian spokespeople have protested that, and I'm waiting for either the Obama administration or the CIA or somebody to make a formal apology, but it hasn't happened yet.
Absolutely. But again, it's how symbolism, how it's so easy to label people and demonize them and then not really deal with the reality of their situations. In your case, James, you became, in a way, more visible and more famous than you ever intended to be. It's just one of the activists on that bus that day. But, you know, by virtue of the fact that you were attacked, and as viciously as you were, your story became, in a sense, a symbol of what was happening into the civil rights movement, you know, to Americans, and not just black Americans, but, you know, people who are standing up for justice. And I think that people remember that, Jim, and honor you for it.
Well, I do know that the picture was seen literally around the world. And one of the principles of nonviolence is that innocent suffering can educate and transform. And I think it's certainly true in those situations when they saw the pictures of Jim Beck, or they saw the pictures of John and myself. It moved the conscience of people. And people who maybe were quiet for the most part decided, hey, it's time to speak up, and why isn't the federal government getting involved? And it really put the pressure not only on the federal government, on the Kennedys, but on the local governments. I mean, Patterson was seen, you know, to be almost a farce in the way he had handled things.
Well, last word, Jim, to Bill Zimmerman, author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s, a really must-read book that I became engrossed with, even though I knew or thought I knew everything. It turned out I certainly didn't. And Bill has done a great job in recreating that moment. But you also, at the end, Bill, reflect on the 60s and the activism of that era. Obviously, tactics have changed. You've become a political consultant working in electoral politics and on issue advocacy and the like. But what are your final thoughts about this is for this program, about what we can learn from this?
Well, I think people like Jim, who launched the civil rights movement in the very earliest years of the 1960s, helped create what became a multi-generational struggle for the soul of America. And that struggle still goes on today. We see it in the division of our country into red and blue states and in the cultural wars that still engulf us. And I think a look back to those years is vitally important in order to understand some of the problems that we have yet to solve in our country today.
Let me say amen to that. Let me say that that's part of the spirit that animates this program every week here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, News Dissector Radio. You are certainly welcome to take the podcast that we're going to be posting on my blog at newsdissector.com and share it with friends. It's also going to be on the Progressive Radio Network.com site. You could also write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Any comments you might have for our guests, I'd be happy to pass them on to them. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being part of this program. And let's keep this fight going.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets.